Okay, well, good evening, everyone. Welcome back. And today we're starting something which will last, I imagine, for the rest of our weeks up to Easter. And it will involve eventually, which means a bit later on this evening, by focusing in on one gospel. So actually, we're looking at the gospels with one gospel in particular. That's what's going to occupy us. And you'll soon know which one it is. But I want to start generally with perhaps some very basic questions, really, but also gathering a bit of useful information all around by thinking about the Gospels as a whole. So I want you to imagine, first of all, that you're talking to someone who has never seen a Bible before, no idea what it's all about, and in fact, they're just being given, if you like, a New Testament. That will do, just give them the New Testament, and they open it up, and they're sort of flicking through it to see what's in it, and they're asking you to explain. And you've got to obviously explain to them what these first four books that's in this New Testament is about, or basically what would be a good definition of a gospel. I'll just let someone else in. What do you think is a good definition of a gospel? In particular, how would you explain it to someone who has never read the Bible, knows nothing about Christianity? So it can be a short definition, or it can be a very long involved one, but anything you think is useful to help someone understand what it is they're going to read if they've not read anything like this before. Nobody got any ideas. Yes, Rosalind.
Is it explaining how man can be reconciled to God through Christ?
Okay, so you want to focus on
that's what a very basic tip.
Yeah, we want to focus on what its main message is, if you like, then. Yeah, okay.
God's word in images, God's words in images. Do they know what the word image means?
Okay, is this actually defining what we think a gospel is about?
Well, it says God's word, isn't it, presumably?
Yeah, but anything specifically about it being a gospel? Malcolm, we got your hand up.
Yeah, all I was going to say was two words, good news.
Yes, that's a good start. What the word actually means, it means good news. Do you know why it means that or where that's come from? Let's let someone else in. Is it a translation of the word or does it just a description that we give to it? Betty?
I think I'd start by asking them what they knew about God.
Well, okay, but I just want to dig into the point of what these first four books are about, or why they're there and what they're about. It is the good news, but it comes from the word, or the words, I suppose it's one word, I think, Godspell. You heard of Godspell? Then gospel comes from that. Got someone else's camera flickering there. I suppose the sort of thing I was asking you to see whether or not you came up with this is, would you say that it's a gospel was a biography? Does that make sense? Is it a biography? And if not, why not? Yes, John. Both.
Yes, I think it's definitely a biography, and I would explain to someone it's the story of one man who did truly live, but told from four different points of view, because the four different points of view are related to the four audiences they hope to reach.
Okay, so we're coming on to the fact that there's four of them, which is an important point in a moment. Would they today understand, if you said it's a biography, would they... What do they know of a biography that would mean that was a good way of describing it or not? Would it fulfill what people think of as a biography?
Well, I think you'd have to explain it's the story of one man's life.
Okay. But today, if you've got a biography of someone, you expect a very full account of everything about them. Including, obviously, right back at the beginning of their life, all the way through, and so on. would you say that the gospel gives us everything about the life of Jesus?
Absolutely not, because he's still alive. He's still doing things.
Okay, but all right, but, finished. Okay, but let's keep it to the idea of the life of Jesus between his birth and his death, then. Does it fulfill the idea of a biography from that point of view, Betty?
No, I think I'd probably say it's the story of one man's mission. Well, who came to Earth with a mission. It's a story of that time on Earth fulfilling his mission.
Right. So it's not just his life story then, it's the story of the purpose behind his life and that sort of thing. Okay,
yeah,
that narrows it down a bit more. The point is, they're not really biographies because there's so many more things that Jesus did that we don't know anything about, including, of course, his childhood. And in two cases, we know nothing about his birth from those two particular gospels. So you don't have a biography that begins when someone's an adult, or you don't have a biography that doesn't say anything about his formative years, if you like. So a biography wouldn't be a good modern description of what a gospel is, because they would expect something that isn't there. Point of view. You can say it's centered upon a person. You can say it's going to tell us a lot about this person's life, and as you just said, about his mission and so on. But they would be confused if they started reading it and was expecting it to be like a biography that they get of someone else. Alison and then Malcolm.
So it's each gospel is written with a purpose in mind.
Yeah, so okay.
It's a facet of the life of Yeshua, but written to a particular audience or with a particular purpose.
Okay.
So John's gospel, for example.
Yeah, don't go into examples now because I'm going to ask you that later. But that would follow on. The next question would be, why have we got more than one, which we'll come to in a minute. But I'm still trying to dig into the fact, what is a gospel? What do we mean by that word? Malcolm?
All I was going to say was that the Gospels are a teaching on how we should live our lives, and also explaining who the man is who's telling us how to live our lives.
Okay, that's part of what they're about, if you like. Yeah. Who else we got? Lynn?
The Christian message.
Okay. You might want to say then the origins of Christianity. Or the origins of the emergence of Christianity, anyway, the one thing you're doing it. Would you tell... Oh, we've got Rosalind again.
Would you say it's a manual?
Be more precise. What does that mean? What do you understand?
In terms of, as you would have a manual for any sort of... for a car or for an electrical appliance, explaining how to... how to work with that. So the manual is showing us how we should live, how we should be reconciled to God through Christ.
That's not specific to the Gospels, though. That's that sort of thing is included in all the books of the Bible, really, to some extent. So it doesn't sort of define the Gospel part of it. We've got John again.
So does it mean good news? Good news for living, good news for life?
Yeah, I think definitely you want to say it is good news. You've got to explain this word gospel is good news. Does the word gospel actually appear in the Gospels? Or is it a word that we've attached to it? We call it a gospel rather than do the books themselves call themselves gospels? Pat, are you there? You want to say something? Pat, your hand's up, Pat, but you're muted and... not there. Let's see.
Right. Okay. Well, it's good news, but it's good news about the kingdom.
Well, okay, you've got to define more what the good news is about. Yes. Yes. Can't you say it's good news? Because that could be anything. So you need a bit more detail after that. Yeah. Betty?
I think I'd mentioned that it's a continuation of what's already been written.
Okay. Yeah. Do any of the Gospels refer to themselves as Gospels? Is it an actual biblical word, or is it a word that we have put to these books? almost in retrospect.
I think we've made it up. We've put it to them. That's my understanding.
Okay, Pat. Pat, are you there again? Do you want? If you put your hand.
I don't think it's actually mentioned in the Gospels at all as gospel.
Okay.
Good news, but not gospel.
Right. Do you want to be a bit more precise on that?
Well, it always rises.
I don't know. I can't hear you anymore now.
It's good news about the kingdom, God's kingdom.
Yes.
And how it's on the doorstep into something new.
Let's see what John and Jan have to say, and then others.
It's not mentioned as such in the Gospels. They don't use the term. It's mainly Paul who describes them as the Gospels.
I'll be careful there. He doesn't. But I know what you're sort of saying. We're getting a little bit sort of lots of bits and pieces here. I'll go through the others and then I'll try and answer my own questions effectively. Rosalind?
It's a fulfillment of the law. So it completes the... So it's a fulfillment of the Old Testament because we can't keep the commandments and the law. Christ came and he fulfilled the law. So it's good news in that sense.
Okay, Malcolm.
It's good news in the sense that you don't have to. We're all born on the way to the lake of fire, but you don't have to go there.
Right, okay. These are all things that you might expect someone would discover as they read through them. Let me answer my own question. Look at Mark chapter 1 and verse 1. Mark chapter 1 and verse 1 is the only gospel that talks about itself as a gospel. Now, it won't use the word because it's an English word, and therefore it has to use the meaning of it, which is about the one thing we said about it. It says the beginning of the good news. Okay. So this is the only gospel which we would say declares itself to be a gospel. And in fact, in verse 14 of Mark chapter 1, you've got the same word, or obviously phrase, which, do you know what it would be in Greek? What is the phrase for good news in Greek that you would find in those verses? I think I know, but... And we're going to have a go, Alison. Are you going to tell us?
Evangelion.
Yeah, I think that's it. Evangelion. In other words, from where we get the idea of the evangel or evangelists. So in that sense, we might think of them not as gospels, but as evangelistic books, if you like. They're proclaiming a message of good news, of salvation, and so on. But perhaps the main point behind all this, which might be why you found it difficult to answer my question, is that there's no other books that you would call a gospel in the same sort of way. We've attached this word to them because there's no other way of describing them. The best way to describe them is to find a new term, a new category, because they don't fit anything else. Okay, so they have been defined, if you like, through this concept of an evangelion, if you like, or an evangel, a message of good news. And then you've been explaining to me in some of the ways in which this message comes out. Malcolm, again.
You say the salvation, but salvation from what?
Yes, okay. Yeah, all of these things need unpacking further, but you're just trying to explain that, you know, it's not a letter, it's not a poetry book, it's not this and that and the other. Would you tell the people that it was a history book? Would you say, when you open your New Testament and start to read, you're reading a history book? You're not sure?
It includes history, but it's not necessarily history.
I think that's a good way of getting around the dilemma. Can you explain this any further? Do you know why you've said that, if you like?
Yeah, because because things actually happened, and therefore, you know, they're not in some individual's imagination. It's not a fantasy,
right?
Fiction,
exactly.
Therefore,
okay.
It's historical.
It's historical. Yeah, there's a difference between a book being historical as opposed to being history, because in fact, the idea of history as we know it now, and what someone would understand if you said, here's a book of history, read this about Jesus and so on, it's a book of history, they would try and compare it with what history has become, which has only really been around in its current form for a couple of hundred years.
Mm-hmm.
So history is a fairly modern sort of idea. So yes, we need to again carefully sort of define and be a bit more particular about what we mean if we start to say it's got history in it. It is. But again, it falls short of what a history is in our modern sense. All of this is heading towards the fact that these are quite unique books in that sort of way. So I asked you a difficult question by saying, what's a good definition of it? It's almost as though if you didn't have these four books, you wouldn't know what a gospel was. Okay? That they have to sort of almost define themselves in terms of their own genre, because they don't fit anything that's previously been in place. All right, let's come back to another question then that you were going to say something about. Why do we have four then? Why does our New Testament start by being very repetitive and having not one of these books, but four of them? We've already hinted at this a little bit, so I want to come back to that point, why we've got four.
They're just four different points of view.
Okay.
They're not points of view, but ways of looking at what happened.
Yeah, okay. I understood what you meant, and I was going to put a different word in. But Alison, do that next verse.
I'm just trying to think which book. I think it might be Ezekiel, where there's the four faces.
Ah, okay.
The lamb, the lion, and something else.
Right. Okay.
So each one kind of directed at these different facets.
Facets, yes, okay. The word Malcolm was sort of using without using it, would be the word perspective.
You're muted, Paul.
Yeah, thank you. I've just seen that. I don't know why that happened. Does anyone know why I said it was muted? I don't think you missed much anyway. I was pointing out that we get four perspectives of them, if you like, as though you've got one subject, but four different painters coming along and painting something which will look very similar, but also slightly different because of the personal perspective that they're bringing, as opposed to putting four cameras in place and just clicking the four cameras, you'd end up with four very similar photographs if you do it at the same time. So they are portraits from that point of view of a person. So you could define a gospel, if you like, as a particular portrait of a person, and then expand it from there in terms of the message and the purpose of it and so on. Was someone else going to say something? I think a hand went up and down again. Can't remember, perhaps it wasn't. People have tried to make all sorts of issues out of the fourness of it. Interesting, you mentioned the four creatures of Ezekiel chapter 1. And I don't know if you know this, but the four Gospels have had these creatures allocated to them effectively by tradition, no other good reason, that the lion is Matthew's Gospel, the ox is Mark, the man is Luke, and the eagle is John. I mean, there you are. I've told you, now forget it, because that doesn't help to distinguish them at all. Other people have come up with the fact that there's four Gospels because there are four directions, north, east, south, and west. So somehow that explains why we've got four, not three or five. There's the four corners of the earth. But even if you want to be a bit more sort of spiritual or biblical about it, say, well, there were four rivers which flowed out of Eden, or the river divided into four as it flowed out of Eden. Perhaps that's the reason why there's four. And of course, there's the four living creatures in Revelation as well. Not sensible stuff, to be honest. And as we've already said, the main thing is, it's a little bit like in Deuteronomy where we're told it's better to have two or three witnesses rather than just one. The more witnesses you have to something, the better the understanding is that you get, and so that there is four. Let's think about the four people that's attached to these, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. We all learned that very early on. Do any of the Gospels describe themselves as being written by Matthew, Mark, Luke, or John? Because today, you know, you'd be able to say clearly who the author is of any book, because it has to be very carefully designated.
Luke.
How do we know it's by Luke? And I don't know who said that, by the way, but are you saying that that's the only one where we're very clear that it's by Luke? If whoever said that ought to say a bit more on that.
How I'm struggling now.
Okay.
Yeah, I thought Luke has said it was Luke, but he doesn't.
No gospel writer names themselves. Now, I'll jump ahead to another interesting point about this, of course, is because Luke's gospel has got detached from part two, which is what we call the book of Acts. Again, that's our designation for it. It's sort of clear in the book of Acts that when Luke comes on the scene, he could well be the person that's starting to write all this up afterwards. And we know the opening of Luke suggests that someone has historically investigated and put something together based upon research of that kind. But again, it's a bit of a deduction rather than, like you get today, author named and so on. So we might ask indeed, who are these people? Are we clear who they actually are? Are we happy with the fact that their names are attached to these books? Let's take them in order, perhaps. What about Matthew? If it really is by Matthew, then who would this Matthew be? And would this make sense? Given there's no internal evidence, if you like.
He was a tax collector.
So you're equating him to the apostle that was known as Levi in the Gospels themselves, and that later on he was the one that wrote it down. Yeah, that's the fair assumption of all this. In which case, he was one of the original 12, yeah? What about the second gospel? We'll just call it the second gospel from that point of view. Any clues about who this person was? Was he one of the apostles?
Could it be John Mark?
Okay, yeah.
Although I think there is some kind of theory that it was actually written with the aid of Peter.
Right. So who is John Mark then, having put that forward?
Well, he was the youngest one, wasn't he? Wasn't he the one that lost his cloak at the
right
rest of Jesus?
Okay. But he wasn't one of the 12, was he?
No.
Not one of the list of the 12. Okay. So if it was John Mark, who later comes into the story, as we know, from that point of view, it could well make sense. But you're quite right that really the second gospel is really regarded as Peter's gospel. Things seem to be told through John Mark and his association with Peter. So this is where the authorship becomes a bit more fluid, if you like. Where did John Mark get his information from? Well, he must have got it from someone. And Peter is the one that has seemed to be the man behind it and all the stuff. Luke, we've already said, is someone who comes into the Christian story not until you've got Paul converted and is travelling around. So he's nowhere near the events as they actually happened. He certainly wasn't an eyewitness. He wasn't anywhere around in that place at all during this time. So when you think about the Gospel of Luke, it makes, if you like, I say no sense, but I need to sort of qualify that. It only makes sense in its context of being linked to the book of Acts. It's really one single two-volume work. It is Luke Acts. if we want to use those words that we attach to them, Luke and Acts. So the question, if you like, is why did Luke decide to write a gospel? It's really because he decided to write the book of Acts and felt that it needed a backstory. It's not that he wrote his gospel and then later on got involved with Paul and went round and was involved in that sort of thing. And the Acts is like sort of a sequel, like sort of Luke part two. It's almost like if he was going to write what happens with Paul on the journeys and tell the story that we know of in the book of Acts, he decided that he would write a gospel to go with it. And therefore, he did the research necessary for that. We'll have Lynn now, and then I'll finish off on that.
I've heard it taught that the reason Acts was written was it was written for Paul to use a defence at one of his trials. And that's why it was so researched and addressed to the person it was, and why it was so much buttering up the Romans and being saying how great the Romans were in rescuing Paul, et cetera, et cetera.
Yes, there's a lot in that, and I would go along with that very much. Which also explains why the book of Acts ends rather bizarrely with Paul still awaiting trial and we don't know the outcome of it, and it's not the end of Paul's life. So it's almost being presented as evidence for the defence, but and that fits in what I was just saying, that it makes it a better evidence for the defence if you've got a gospel to go in front of the book of Acts so you can explain what it was all about. And we now begin to think about the purpose behind each book rather than just the person that wrote it. But sometimes you can't distinguish that. And the last gospel by John, who do we think John is? Because it's a very common name.
Wasn't he a half-brother to Jesus?
No, Jesus didn't have a half-brother called John. Anyway, that was James.
The disciple that Jesus loved.
Okay, so
and this back on his breast at the last.
So this very much suggests it is the apostle John, one of the 12, and who was also like Peter and James, very much the forefront of that. And so when Jesus was choosing his disciples, he would have known in advance, or he would have known when he was choosing people, that some of them were going to actually eventually record things, not at the time, but much later. And so John was probably lined up for this task of producing a gospel. Come back to that in a minute. Pat, are you coming in again?
Isn't it John, the son of Zebedee?
Yes, that's right. Yeah. Again, you can't tell that from the gospel, but we assume it is that particular apostle, and therefore it is the one that Jesus called. The fisherman and so on. And if it is that John, which we'll assume it is, then he was also responsible for writing some letters and ultimately the book of Revelation. So whereas Luke, if you like, gets top spot because he wrote more of the New Testament than anyone else when you put Luke and Acts together, because it's a long gospel plus another very long book as part of it, it's two volume work. By the time you've put together Revelation and the letters and John's gospel, that's another very sizable chunk of the whole of the New Testament scriptures. So in that sense, there is a bit of a mixture of the authors. We got two people who were actual disciples, apostles, one other who was around at the time, possibly coming into the story a bit later, and one who arrived much, much later and had to go back and research. So now another point, which someone was beginning to mention, is why did they bother to do this at all? Any thoughts come from you, first of all, any thoughts on any particular gospel as to why that one is there? Or just generally? Think about the purpose of them now, the reason behind them.
John's gospel was to show that Jesus was the Son of God.
Yes. So from that point of view, that was a perspective that he wanted to give. Okay. There's a bit more to it than that, but we'll go through other people. Looks like it's Rose rather than John this time.
And Luke makes it clear that he did it to present an orderly account of what had happened. So clearly, he must have been exposed to disorderly accounts to want to set out an orderly account and just to get things straight.
I wonder what the word orderly actually means there. I know how we take it. We tend to think it means more chronological, better from that point of view. Does that mean that if we get a conflict between the order of events in, say, Mark and Luke, then we should say that Luke got it right because that was his aim? Or was he just, if it wasn't meant to be a defence, then it would have to be presented in a good fashion like that. It was almost part of his attempt to persuade someone of the stature of this Theophilus, if he is a real person rather than just an interesting sort of pseudonym for anybody who's reading it, he would make sure he presented it in a certain way that was suitable for them. Let's keep going through others. Alison next.
So Matthew wrote kind of specifically with a lot of Jewish stuff, Jewish genealogies, Jewish thought, to present the gospel to Jewish people, to tie up the covenants.
Yeah.
The chronology in Jewish thought isn't so important. So if you're reading something like Genesis, the account of Yaakov going back into the land, it then has this piece about his father dying. Well, his father had died at a different time, but it kind of ties in. A piece of the narrative. So chronology is not that important in Jewish.
No, you're right. And that's why they're not history books in that sense that we would imagine there would be today. As I said, they're historical without being history. In fact, it makes, I don't find this a problem at all, that actually a gospel writer might move an event around in order to bring out a different meaning for it, if you like, or to put it in juxtaposition with another event in order to build a bigger picture out of those two bits. Let's keep going through what we've got. Pat, next, I think. Pat?
I think it's in generally as well, because Jesus died in the 30s, then and the apostles were dying off, they wanted a written account.
Yeah, that's a very good point. I'll pick that up in just a moment, but we've got John or Jan waiting. Thanks.
Yes, Pat's making more or less the point that I was going to.
Yeah.
The early Christians expected Christ to return within their lifetime.
Yeah.
And when it began to become apparent that may be not the case,
yeah,
they thought, well, those of us who were around had better record this.
Yes. And that now comes to the next tricky question of the dating of them. When were they done? Which scholars debate endlessly on all this, but certainly not at the time of Jesus, not even immediately afterwards, because at that point, the gospel, which is the mean, I didn't get back to this point, when Paul uses the word gospel, he is not referring to a written account. The gospel in this case is the kerygma, the preached message of the good news of Jesus. So I'm not ashamed of the gospel, doesn't mean I'm not bothered, I'm not ashamed by the book called Matthew or the book called Mark. He's talking about, I'm not ashamed of the message of preaching Christ as the good news of salvation. Because actually, Paul probably never saw a gospel written down. If you think about it. If Paul died as he did somewhere around AD 60 or whatever, it may well be that some of the gospels were not, certainly not in the written form that we have today. So in fact, his letters, some of his earlier letters would be the first written, what we would think of now as scriptures, part of the New Testament. So again, the New Testament isn't arranged in any chronological order itself. We just put the Gospels there first because they make more sense to be put at the beginning of the New Testament. Why we put them in the order Matthew, Mark, Luke and John, we'll just hold for that for a moment. But certainly there came a point, let's say from the 60s onwards, a sort of generation afterwards, where it was decided that it was a good idea to write these down. So the next sort of question is, I wonder where they were written then, because at that point, where was Matthew and Mark and Luke and John? Well, coming back to Luke, we've already said he was probably on his travels with Paul somewhere. So he must have eventually had time to do some writing up, probably when Paul was in prison, and therefore he wasn't travelling around as part of Paul's team of evangelists. It's thought that Matthew was probably written in Antioch. That's Antioch, the Antioch where they were first called Christians. I think it's the Syrian Antioch, isn't it? And there is some thought there that although Matthew might have been there at the time and involved in it, it's perfectly possible that someone else, or even, and this is a theory rather than anything else, but it was almost like a community effort that a church or the community of believers in Antioch wrote it up on the basis of what Matthew had already taught them or left with them, because there may well have been other written parts of it which would eventually form the gospel. In other words, there was something written down and it was eventually decided we'll take those bits and we'll write them up in this way. Where would Mark's gospel have been written? Some people think Rome, I think, is one option as to where, but it might depend wherever Peter was at that time. And then what about John's gospel? What do you know that's different about John's gospel? Yeah, John.
Well, he says he's on the island of Patmos.
Well, that's the book of Revelation.
Oh.
That's not the gospel.
Oops, sorry.
Two parts. The suggestion is that the earlier part was written first and the rest many years later. I don't know the evidence for that, but
okay,
that heard. So the first chapter, I suppose, or even part of the first chapter, which of course marries really wonderfully well with the first part of Genesis.
Yeah, quite possibly deliberately copying it, yeah.
Yeah.
I've not heard of this idea that John's gospel was written in two parts.
Two times, should I say, two times.
Well, okay, but some of it was written at one time and then the rest of it was picked up later or something.
Yeah, okay. I can't remember where I discovered that thought, but the question was that the majority of it was done at the same time that the letters and or a similar time. In fact, some suggested, some that I saw, was that it was written after Revelation even. So,
well, you may have heard that idea from me because I do mention that.
Oh, well, maybe.
Not because I'm convinced of it or it's my pet theory or something. The main point is that John's gospel has all the hallmarks of being a lot later than the others, okay? Mm. Because John lived longer, he outlived all the others, and maybe his experience on Patmos led to him eventually writing up the first part of his gospel in the way that he did, because he'd had a new experience of Jesus, and therefore he wanted not just to churn out the same things again, but to write from a very different perspective. We'll come back to that in a minute. I thought Alison was going to say something.
I was. John's gospel is obviously not a so-called synoptic gospel.
Yeah.
It has major themes. So it has seven I ams, it has seven signs, etc.
Yeah. Which so makes it...
It's much more structured in a kind of way to show... who Jesus was, rather than kind of no, I'm not explaining that very well, but there is a certain different structure to it.
Yes. Okay. Right. You're right in all this. Structure is an interesting thing. I'll say something more about it in a moment, but he has a very particular structure, and all these sevens, because there's the seven I ams, there's the seven signs, there's the seven witnesses and so on. That does rather suggest that he might have got that idea from the book of Revelation, where there's a whole load of sevens, or at least, if you like, it fits his style of writing like that, which might be another good idea for it being around that time, at least. But you've mentioned the word synoptic, which I'm coming to in a minute, but you can imagine that years later, John has decided, if we need a fresh perspective, I'm not going to just go back and write the same thing in the same way. And he does focus more on who Jesus is. Someone, I think, earlier said John's focus is Jesus as the Son of God, which is fair enough. We might think in a moment what the other gospel writers therefore focus on. But it's sometimes been explained that the other three give us the normal three dimensions as a perspective, but John comes on top of it all and has a sort of view from above on Jesus, which is why he starts off with him being the eternal word and so on, rather than just being born on earth. So he has a very different perspective, but certainly his gospel is several years, probably 20, 30 years after the others. And as to where, well, the chances are therefore it was Ephesus, because John by then was based in Ephesus, and that was around the time of going to exile on Patmos and so on. So four very different people, four very different what you might call readership or intended readership. It's quite possible, therefore, that, as you said, if Matthew's gospel was written more for a Jewish audience, and that would be Jewish converts to Christianity. I don't think it's written as an evangelistic sort of tract. It's there to teach Christians, new believers of a Jewish heritage, Jewish background. Then Mark is very different. He's writing to Gentiles. Luke is very much writing it as a Gentile perspective, probably with this more evangelistic trait to it. Whereas John, no one's yet mentioned what John says his purpose behind writing it is. He says, this is written so that you may believe that Jesus is, and I think then it says the Son of God and so on, and that you might go on believing, so that you might go on having life. So John makes his purpose behind it very clear by the time you get to the end. And he also says, I haven't had time or opportunity to write down everything that I could have done. We could have a whole library of books on Jesus and you still haven't got it all, which is why no one is a biography, no one is a historical account and so on. It's almost a selection of things that those particular authors thought was most important when they wanted to portray Jesus in the way that he was. So when you're reading one of these, you would say, what's the picture of Jesus that's coming through from this particular author? Now, in Matthew sometimes is called the royal gospel. It's sometimes called the teacher's gospel, because its particular emphasis on Jesus is that he is the son of David, if you like. That's what the genealogy is all about, that he is the king of the Jews. He is of the royal line of David. And also highlighted very much in Matthew's gospel is that Jesus is a rabbi. He is a teacher. And we're taken through in the structure of Matthew's gospel, the way in which he called disciples, taught disciples, trained disciples, and eventually left behind disciples to do more of the same thing. So in that sense, someone mentioned Emmanuel earlier. I would say that we could say Matthew, one of its purposes is as a manual for those who want to disciple people in the way that Jesus did, and teach in the way that Jesus did. You get more of that out of that. John's gospel, if you like, is even more theological, if you like. It starts with the great logos idea, and you get all these statements of Jesus' divinity and so on. So he would pick out the events of Jesus' life that would highlight that aspect of it. That leaves Mark and Luke to think of in those terms. And Mark's gospel, from the way it starts and the way it sort of rushes through the whole story, you've almost got here what we might call Jesus, the action hero. That sounds a strange way to call Jesus something like that. But the man of action, the man on a mission, might be a good way of putting it. We're really focusing in. It's almost as though Mark's main purpose is to get us to the cross and the resurrection as quickly as possible. His approach is, let's forget about the birth, let's forget about the early childhood, straight in with his ministry, because I can't wait to get to the point where he dies and rises again. So that's more are more dramatic. It's more of a drama, if you like, and it would suit very well the Roman world. It doesn't debate things in detail. It just tells you things straight, move on to the next thing and the next thing. In the old-fashioned versions, like the authorized version, nearly every verse in Mark began with the word and, the Greek word kai, which is usually translated and, but it can also be translated then and but. But it's an immediate connection. It's like this happened, and then this happened, and then that, and so on. And that's not good style, usually, to start all your sentences with and, but it is if you're wanting to give a quick flow through the whole drama in one go. Luke is probably written up in a more considered approach for the reasons we've mentioned, putting things together to build the case. Firstly, that if the whole purpose is this guy Paul really is right and he shouldn't have been arrested, and also to help them understand at the trial why the Jews kept wanting to get rid of him, then you need the backstory of why Jesus was put to death by the Jews. In other words, basically what happened to Jesus was going to happen to Paul, or what happened to Paul was because of what happened to Jesus. It's got to have that sort of feel to it. And as I say, John was written from a totally different perspective. So this word synoptic, just to make sure you're familiar with that, we call Matthew, Mark and Luke the synoptic gospels. Someone tell me why then, what's the meaning behind this word synoptic, which if you haven't seen it before, it's spelled S-Y-N-O-P-T-I-C. What's that getting at, to call them synoptic? They don't understand the word. John?
It's generally the same story and a lot of the verses line up. Not all of them.
Okay, a bit of a minute. But what about the word itself? Do we understand the meaning of the word?
Synergy?
Well, you can think of other words that begin S-Y-N. That may help you with half of the word.
The synopsis.
Yeah, okay. It's a summary.
Say it again, Alison.
A summary.
No, it's not quite that. No, it's not quite the same as a synopsis. I know what you're saying there, yeah. But there is the summary aspect of it, yes. What does optic suggest? Yes, someone's pointed his eye. But perspective again, isn't it? Okay. So
see and view.
So again, sorry, Lynn.
I'm cheating though.
Oh, go on.
S-Y-N, which means together.
Yeah.
And optic, which means see or view.
Yeah. So it's having a same or very similar viewpoint. It's like looking through, it's like these three are all looking in the same sort of way. Okay. They are like a word like, what does synagogue mean? It's a gathering together, isn't it? It means a togetherness. And that's the same behind synthesis. And someone mentioned the synergy and so on. So it's a togetherness because there's such a huge similarity between the first three, and then John is totally different, which is why it's a good idea to think of those three as forming the normal sort of perspectives from all the three directions. And then there's an extra view, which is coming from a totally different perspective. It is not synoptic with the other three, which doesn't make it any truer or less true or better or worse. It's just saying that they're different. So there is a huge amount of overlap between Matthew, Mark and Luke, and virtually no overlap, very little compared to John. Almost it's like saying, I'm not even going to attempt to put things together in the way that they did. This has led to what scholars like to call the synoptic problem, but it's not a problem. Puzzle would be a better word, which is, which gospel was written first, and did any gospel writer know about the others when they started writing theirs? What have you heard about that as to whose gospel was probably written first? Again, there's nothing definite about it, but there is a sort of consensus.
Probably Mark.
Mark, yeah. Okay. And then either Matthew or Luke, but of course they could be written at the same sort of time, but in two totally different places. And then John much later. Now, if that's the case, then the question would be, if Mark's gospel was already written and a lot of it is similar to what's in Matthew and in Luke, did they have access to that document? Was it already circulating? And so when they decided to write their own, they thought, well, I've got something here to work on. So we'll start at least with that as a perspective. That's what's behind a lot of the research on this problem. But then, as I've said before, there's no reason why there shouldn't have been some of these incidents, some of these gospel stories already written out and preserved and circulating separately, in which case two gospels can be very similar, not because one's copied the other, but because they both had access to very similar background material, if you like. And it's quite possible that the sayings of Jesus were preserved pretty soon after Jesus, before they became part of a gospel. And then they were incorporated into Matthew, Mark, and Luke in particular at a later stage, because if you're going to write a message of the good news about Jesus, you need to know what he said. And that's one of the reasons behind the idea that there's some of the sayings and teachings of Jesus were preserved in Hebrew, because the Gospels were later written in Greek, but it really does, as you know from what I've been teaching you, often look as though he really, you know, he was speaking Hebrew. They should have been preserved in Hebrew at some point. No definite physical evidence on all that, but lots of speculation. Just in case anyone's heard of this, has anyone heard of a document called Q, literally just the letter Q? I can see Jeremy nodding, is that right? Yeah. And Rose there, okay. Now, okay then, who can tell me what Q stands for? Because it's not just a random letter. Anyone know that? Okay, you're gonna learn something then. It comes from a German word, Quelle, if I pronounced it right, which just means source. So all they're saying is, there probably was a source document, so we better give it a name. Well, we'll call it Q, because that's the German for source. No one's found this. It's speculation. But if you try and deconstruct the Gospels that you've got and look for what's in common and what's been added and how the different events have been put together, you can almost sort of reproduce something that might have been around at the time. But that's really for the academics. For us as believers, we take the finished article, if you like, and just want to get what we can out of the text. We don't have to worry about how it was put together and so on. But it explains something as to why we've got more than one. Mark's gospel being the shortest, it makes a lot more sense that that was the first one. And then others, if they knew about it, would obviously expand upon it rather than someone reducing it down to a smaller size. So that's one part of it. And it does look as though the best opening gospel really is the one that Mark produced, that the best one to give to someone. We put them in the order Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. You can speculate as to why. It's probably because Matthew starts with the genealogy. So that seems to be the opening of how the New Testament should begin, whereas Mark doesn't bother with the birth. And really, Luke and Acts should be put together, but we have to separate them because we've got John's gospel. So we've decided to play around with that. But it's perfectly possible to start your New Testament with Mark and then include Matthew and Luke, Acts, and then John. Lynn?
In my Bible, there's a little note in Mark after verse 8, because the theory is that it... Oh, everyone's moved around. that it was... not finished, and somebody just finished, yeah. Put a bit on to finish it off. So perhaps,
yeah,
if that was thought to be the case,
yeah,
why would, do you think it was something that happened to Peter, if we're saying it was what something happened to Mark?
Okay, let's first of all be clear which verse 8 you mean.
Oh, sorry, the last one, Mark 16, verse 8.
Right. Mark has got a strange ending, or what's sometimes called a missing ending. Some manuscripts don't have the remaining verses 9 to 20. Mm. So does that mean that originally it stopped at verse 8 and then someone added something on? Or was it that it originally went to verse 20 and a bit of it got lost? Again, academic exercise. I'll just point out at this point that if it ends in verse 8, and that's where it's meant to end, if you like, you end up with everybody being afraid, which is not great. Whereas at least if you read to the end of verse 20, you've got a what I call a better ending to the whole story. But why manuscripts have ended up some with and some without, that is another, it's an interesting point about it. And also sort of adds to the general point that we don't have to think of it as just being one author that's responsible in the way that today someone is responsible for a whole book. And that might be interesting to think about, as you said, with John's Gospel being written in two parts, maybe, or the way Matthew's Gospel might have been compiled within the context of a church saying, we've got all this stuff, and we've got Mark, and we've probably got some other sources. How can we put this together in a way that makes sense? It might have, Matthew's Gospel might have been put together with the purpose of teaching. So it was almost, I'm saying it's a committee effort, but it's like you put together a course for a purpose. It's not like one person necessarily writing a book. Anyway, John or Rose?
Yeah, I quite like the idea of putting John first, and then you can put Luke and Acts together, one after the other. Also, John starts out in the same vein as Genesis, so why not?
Yeah,
Another interesting point is about the genealogy in Matthew. We have had friends, because they since passed, who were doing translation in Borneo, and they didn't bother with the first part of Mark because they thought, well, what does this mean?
Sorry, do you mean Matthew?
Sorry, Matthew.
Yeah.
First part of Matthew. And they didn't bother till towards the end of their translation bit or series. But when they put it together, the local folk said, now we believe what you're saying, because genealogy is really important to them. And it was the trigger, whereas the folk who were translating, British folk, thought, what's the point of this?
And of course, it meant a lot to the Jewish people at the time as well to have this. But you're right, other communities would think, if you can't give me this root, these roots, if you like, this sort of background to it, then it's less believable. So, yeah, it's there for good purpose. But, yeah, it's an interesting idea. Start with John, because he also says in the beginning. I know that often John's Gospel was handed out as an evangelistic book or tool, as though that would get people converted more. It might get some people converted more from that gospel because of the nature of it, but it might actually be quite difficult for some people. They might want something shorter, less sort of dialogue based, more action based. So there is no strict order for these books when they're put together, because originally, of course, they were separate books. And it doesn't necessarily mean that one is better for this purpose than another. You've got to think, by understanding what each gospel is actually trying to say, what it's trying to do, whether that's better for this person and another one better for another person. I think, Betty, you had your hand up, and then
Yes, I thought perhaps we'd gone past the point, but that was the point of when I said before I'd started to introduce somebody, I'd want to know where they were coming from.
Yeah.
Because it would make such a big difference to how they understood it.
Indeed.
And it's like the perspective we're talking about, the people that write it. You need to think of the perspective of the person that's reading it or listening to it.
Absolutely. In this sense, readership is probably more important than authorship.
Yeah.
From that point of view, or purpose behind it is more important than actually how it was composed and so on. Yeah. Some people have gone to a lot of trouble, particularly with the synoptics, to try and harmonize them into one account. Has anyone come across this idea? Anyone got maybe even some books? Yeah, whose is that one? Gospel Parallels, I can see. Is it a newer version of mine? Who's yours by, John?
Throckmorton.
The Throckmorton, yes. Throckmorton. Yes. Burton H. Throckmorton.
Yes.
I think this is just an older version.
Right. Arnold Fruchtenbaum put out something he called Harmony, but it's the same thing.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, there's been several goes at it. I think there's a very early one with a, what's it? It's got a strange name, like a quatretession or something, which means almost like four things tessellating, four things coming together to form one pattern. So it was attempted not just in modern times. What do you make of that book then, John? Do you use it? Do you find it absolutely vital?
I used to follow David Bivin, which I no longer do, but he recommended it and he always taught using it. And I found it very helpful and very intriguing that there were so many similarities.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. It does highlight, if you're looking at a particular passage, and I just opened it at random here, and we've got Bartimaeus, the healing of Bartimaeus, that you know it's in Matthew 20, Mark 10, verse 18. But the way it's set out, I'll just show you this, you can just get some idea on the page what it looks like. There's gaps because different versions, different gospels say a bit more, and then there's bits where they sort of come together again and so on. In fact, I don't even think they start together in that case, if I'm holding it upright. It can be useful when you're studying a particular event, and it does some of the work for you. But is there a perfect harmony? Well, if everybody tried to do this, would they all come up with exactly the same? The answer is no, probably 90% the same. You can harmonize them up to a point, but not completely. And if you could, that would almost destroy everything we've been saying about why we've got four and why it's useful to have different perspectives and so on. But at the same time, it's important, like we often know, is that witnesses should agree up to a certain amount, but would never agree completely. If you've got three or four different witnesses to an event, you expect them to be roughly similar, but at the same time, if they're producing exactly the same accounts, well, then they've really sort of cribbed each other, haven't they, that point of view. But if you haven't come across the idea of a harmony or gospel parallels, that might be something to look at if you're interested in that sort of thing. I'll just mention one other thing which is coming to my mind. There's a strange word which I used to pronounce as pericope. Pericope, spelt as I'm saying it, pericope. Periscope without the S. Has anyone else heard that word? And anyone know how to pronounce it properly? Because I haven't. I haven't pronounced it properly. I pronounced it as I used to pronounce it in my ignorance in the past. Have you come across this then, Rose?
Yeah. David Bivin always said pericope.
That's it. That's the better way of describing what is a very Greek word, pericope. Now, forget that. What exactly is a pericope then, and why is it important in what we're talking about? What do you know about that?
It took me a long time to figure it out, but I gather it's one segment where they agree. It's one section of the gospel.
It is. The gospel isn't written in chapters. It isn't written in verses. It's written in sections, for want of a better word. It's written in pericopes. It's just a posh word for an event or series of events that's been put together, belong together within the gospel, and then we move on to something else and something else. And that's why you get some common elements between the synoptics, because the same pericopes appear, even if they've got slightly different words attached to them. So, you know, a miracle or a section of Jesus' teaching and so on is classified under that. So I'm only mentioning that so that you realise that when it's written, they're compiled in these different sections, not just, obviously, chapters and so on. Who we got? Oh, Rose again.
I just thought it might be worth mentioning that if anybody invests in Throckmorton, one of these synoptic gospels, and somebody's talking about it, he'll say pericope 30. So right. You go to the book and you look up pericope 30, and it'll be that particular harmonization of those sections of the gospels.
Okay, thank you. I mean, in mine, I've got a huge introduction as to how it's been done and all the different manuscripts and then how it's been put together and so on, and a very useful sort of index-based contents of what the thing looks like. But we might do a little study of that kind later. But it's probably well past the time when I'm going to tell you which gospel we're going to look at for the next few weeks. I won't ask you to guess. I'm not going to treat it as a puzzle like I often do. But it's going to be Mark. We're going to look at Mark's gospel in hopefully the 5 weeks or so that we've got left, partly because it is shorter. It's a little more straightforward to work your way through it. What I want us to end up with when we come to the last one in March is then when we come to the plot and the trial of Jesus, what I've said Mark is really heading towards, the whole message of the cross and the resurrection, then we'll look at it from all four Gospels and we'll harmonize that across the four. But we will focus on reading through Mark's Gospel. And so one of the things you might like to do ready for next time is start to read it. And I'll probably give you some idea of probably how far we'll get each time, but save that for later. So if we're looking at Mark's Gospel then, and now you can open it at Mark, unless there's something else interesting to say about the Gospels as a whole, I think it's time for us to start to focus on one. We've already mentioned it, its opening is, this is the one that at least defines itself as being a declaration of gospel, good news, evangelon, the beginning of good news about Jesus the Christ, the Messiah, the Son of God, and so on and so on and so on. But what we're going to do now is just a little exercise. I'm going to give you four references. We'll look these up together and then comment upon them. I think let's pick this one first of all. Okay, so can you find chapter 3 and verse 17? Chapter 3, verse 17. And then if you can hold your finger in that, chapter 5, verse 41. So that's 317 and 541. And 734. And chapter 10, verse 46. Now you can guess, coming up in a moment, is what do those four have in common? Make sure you find them. I'll say them again. 317, 541, 734, 1046. What do those four all have in common, just by looking at them, really? And then does that help explain something? Three 17, 541, 734, and 1046.
He.
Sorry, Lynn, you saying something?
He. It's that they all say he.
Do they? Okay. Well, there might be loads more verses that all say he.
Yeah.
But there should be something else that stands out in all of them.
And they all give a translation.
Yes. They should all have got something in brackets. Is that... Hopefully most translations have done it like that, which is part of the visual clue. But in the brackets, there is a translation of something. So let's go through them in order now. What's the first one telling us about? 317. What's it translating, if you like? What's it?
Boanerges, the sons of thunder.
Right. So... Mark has decided that we ought to be told what Boanerges means, because otherwise we won't know. What's in the chapter 5 and verse 41? Where's a little explanation?
The Talitha Kumi.
Right, which means, little girl, I say to you, get up. He's not expecting his readers to know that themselves. He's having to explain it to them. What about 7:34? Yeah, which means be opened. And the last one, he explains the meaning, I think, of the name Bartimaeus, which I would hope that most Bible scholars of your repute would know that Bartimaeus means son of Timaeus. But Mark is doing this. Why? Because these are all Hebraic phrases, Aramaic if you prefer, names and so on, that his Gentile readers in the Roman world wouldn't know what it was about. So he's providing a little translation stroke commentary on it because his readers will be unfamiliar. And that gives us some idea of why he's done that and what his readership's like. Lynn?
Sorry, have yours literally got brackets in them?
Well, I have in my NIV version.
Right, because ours doesn't have brackets.
Okay.
I understood it when you were talking, but mine doesn't have brackets in it at all.
But it will still say Bartimaeus, which means.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
It does say that, but it doesn't have the bracket. Okay.
So it's still the same common point of translating, interpreting for us what would be a very foreign term to his Gentile readers. Let's do something similar with the following. Chapter 7, and this is verses 1 to 5. So we will we won't read all that at the moment. Just find it. Chapter 7 and the first 5 verses. I'll tell you what this is about. These are the times when Mark, compared to some of the others, feels that he has to explain Jewish customs and things like that. So, for instance, again, I've got brackets here around verses 3 and 4, which you may or may not have. But instead of just saying that the Pharisees and some teachers of the law gather around Jesus and talk about eating food with hands that's defiled, unwashed, he then explains the Pharisees and all the Jews do not eat unless blah, blah, blah. When they come from the marketplace, they do not eat, et cetera, et cetera. So again, his Gentile readership needs to be told some extra information before we can eventually reach the point of, and so they spoke to Jesus and said this. So he's providing information that a Jewish readership probably wouldn't need, but that his Gentile readership would. There's one or two others, like in Mark 12, 18. Yeah, Malcolm, what do you want to say now?
In Mark 7, the parenthesis is the whole of verse 3 and 4.
Yeah, if someone's put brackets in, that's because that is a lengthy explanation. You could read verses 1, 2 and jump to 5 if you knew your stuff. But he's providing quite a lengthy extra bit in this case, yeah. In chapter 12 and verse 18, there's no brackets this time, as well, I can see, but he feels it's important to tell us that the Sadducees don't believe in the resurrection, whereas most people around then at the time would know that's what the Sadducees believed or didn't believe, but he adds that in. And I think in chapter 14, at one point, 14 and verse 12, chapter 14 and verse 12, on the first day of the festival of unleavened bread, he adds, when it was customary to sacrifice the Passover lamb. Again, Jews would know that, Gentiles, probably useful extra information to help. And he says something similar later on, in chapter 15 and verse 42, it was preparation day, now brackets, that is, the day before the Sabbath, again, Gentiles, and therefore it's useful for us to know what is this preparation day then? So he's taking the trouble to explain a bit more. John, Rogers? Yes.
I was just interested, what is Lynn's translation? What's her Bible? What translation is
that? New King James.
Right.
All right. Thank you. That's all.
Right. Good point. And something else that we've got hidden away occasionally is that he uses some Latin words in chapter 15 and verse 16, for instance, if you're already in that area. He talks about the praetorium. The soldiers led Jesus away into the palace, and so that his Roman readers feel a bit more at home with what he's saying. Oh, that's called the praetorium, and so on. And I think there's one or two other places where they may or may not be translated in our English in a certain way, but he uses the Latin equivalent, or the Roman equivalent, if you like. Yes, for instance, in our version, with the poor widow comes in and puts two small copper coins worth only a few pence, he would actually be saying denarius and that sort of thing. Now, the other thing, which if we go back to the opening of Mark, as we said, no birth story here. It's not going to hold us up with anything about birth, childhood, or anything like that. Straight into the good news. One of the first things that he does is he quotes something from the Old Testament. So if you've got the opening of Mark open, you know, you've got back to the beginning. And if you just start to flick through generally and look for Old Testament quotes. So you've got one there in chapter 1, verses 2 and 3. Your footnotes will tell you that it's from Isaiah and Malachi, all very helpful. If you think, I wonder where the next one is, and the next one is, well, I'm turning over and I can't see another one until chapter 4, where there's a quote from Isaiah. You'll either find these from your footnotes at the bottom, or because it looks like there's a quote being done. And I'm turning over again and I can't see any more at all. And I've got all the way to chapter 7 before I find another one from Isaiah and some other bits and pieces from Deuteronomy. So my general point here is he does not use the Old Testament very much. Why? Because again, his readership isn't that used to knowing much about the Old Testament scriptures. Matthew, of course, you bump into them all the time. He's always quoting the Old Testament because that suits his purpose and suits his readership. So that's another feature, if you like, of Mark's gospel, which helps to explain what he's really doing. There is a sense of vividness about his use of words. So I'm giving you some clues here to help you sort of read it, and hopefully this comes across in English. I've said it's a gospel of action. He does record something of Jesus' teaching, but it's not like Matthew's gospel where you get a Sermon on the Mount. It's not like John's gospel where you get great long dialogues. He will intersperse Jesus's teaching into Jesus's actions or his activities and so on. He wants to tell us what Jesus did rather than just what Jesus said. Pat? Pat?
I think as well, though, what there's a lot of nuanced things in Mark's gospel, as in it's marked in the Amplified, such as Mark 1, 11, where he quotes Psalm 2:7 and Isaiah 42:1.
Oh, okay.
So a lot of nuanced things.
Yeah, fair enough. He's quoting what was said at the time, which coincides with scripture. But the opening one in chapter 1 and verses 2 and 3 is Mark himself producing these verses as part of his narrative. I think that was the distinction I wanted to make. Obviously, there will be quotes from parts of the Old Testament where he's recording what Jesus said, or what, in this case, the Father said, and so on. So you'll get that a little bit. But he's not using the Old Testament as a sort of commentary for his own story. Mark records 18 miracles, if you really want to search them out. There are two longish teaching sections, chapter 4, which is most of the chapter, because he puts some of the parables together, you might expect. And at the end, in Mark 13, you've got what we call, in the other book, Gospel, we call the Olivet Discourse, the end times teaching. So there's two occasions when he's put together what we might call a teaching section. But he races us on through the action side of it, and therefore the miracles are particularly important for this. I mentioned how often the word "and" used to come in. And in fact, even in my NIV here, in chapter 1, I've got verse 4, "and so," and verse 7, "and this," and so on. They tend to be translated out, because otherwise it's bad English and it's not a good style. But in Greek, it would still have this. And also, a word that occurs a lot is the word "immediately."
I was just going to say that.
yeah, immediately, or you might be afterwards, or at once. I can see in verse 12, and at once, or it might just be after, and so on. But it's almost like we're moving on. Here's the next bit, the next bit, the next bit, and so on. And he's very down to earth with his descriptions. He'll just say it as it is. In that sense, it's a bit rough and ready, if you like. It doesn't have some of the polish, perhaps, of Luke and the way he probably crafted his gospel and so on. And if there is an overall picture of the Messiah that he wants to give, about the good news, you could say it is the suffering Son of Man. I call it the sort of action hero, but it's Jesus on a mission. It's Jesus fulfilling what God the Father wants him to do. And we learn about him as the suffering servant, really. And like most Gospels, a huge proportion of it is from the time of, shall we say, the Last Supper onwards, or in this case, the anointing. So from chapter 14, we're heading towards the cross. It's all with that in mind, the cross and the resurrection and so on. There is a central point to the gospel. There is a pivot point in the middle somewhere. I won't tell you where that is at this stage, because it's 8:30. And as we work our way through it, though, it will become more apparent. So there we are. Now, next week, which is the 16th, we'll pick this up. And then, as I said, we're going to have a week off, because I'm away in the last week of February. So you'll have plenty of time to do even more reading. The time we start again in March, you should have read the whole gospel. Well, you can have read the whole gospel by then, if you like. So we've got next week, the 16th, then a break, and then March the 2nd, 9th, 16th, possibly the 23rd. We'll see how we get on. But that's what we're going to be doing. We're going to be going through the whole of the gospel fairly quickly, like Mark does, picking out the main points. So we'll probably be doing about four chapters at a time. And the last one, whichever one that is, we will look at the plot, the trial, and the whole Easter story, if you like, but harmonizing it with the other gospels as well. I think that would be useful. Right. Anyone got any final comments or questions before we turn the recording off? Nothing you want to say for the benefit of the entire world. Okay, we'll switch the recording off. And then you can... Are you doing that, Christine? You're trying to. We got there. Save me trying to.